For 54 years, since the early 1970s, the Assad family continually dominated Syria's government. The most serious challenge to the family's long rule over the country erupted in 2011, when protests evolved into revolution, which evolved into full-scale civil war. Then, after nearly a decade of brutal fighting throughout the country that claimed the lives of around 600,000 people and forced more than 6 million others to flee the country as refugees, the war entered into a tenuous ceasefire in 2020 that largely froze the front lines where they stood at the time, which left the Assad regime in control over most of the country's major cities and population centers. Then, over time, most of the world began moving on from the conflict in Syria, and after years had passed with the ceasefire generally holding steady, many began presuming that Assad, along with his Russian and Iranian supporters, had effectively won the war, or that Syria had become a frozen conflict. But then, 4 years into the ceasefire generally holding steady, it was suddenly shattered by a renewed rebel offensive against the government that began at the end of November in 2024. And to the complete shock of just about everybody, this renewed rebel offensive exposed the Assad regime in the country as an empty house of cards. And the Assad family's 54-year-long rule in the country was decisively overthrown in a matter of only 11 days. Since then, this sudden and unexpected collapse of such a long-lasting regime in such a strategically significant country has generated one of the 21st century's most substantial geopolitical earthquakes, the aftershocks of which will be felt far and wide throughout the world as the players on the Middle East chessboard recalibrate their moves and plays now that the board has shifted so dramatically. In particular, the collapse of the Assad regime in Syria will most catastrophically affect what were his regime's two biggest international supporters, Iran and Russia, almost to the point of effectively checkmating both of their ambitions in the Middle Eastern theater permanently. And at the same time, Iran and Russia's enormous geopolitical losses in Syria will be matched by the enormous gains that will go to both Turkey and Israel, the two countries who were the Assad regime's biggest regional opponents. So to understand what the collapse of the Assad regime in Syria means for the future, and how it completely screws over both Iran and Russia, let's start with how it screws over Iran first, and then move on to how it screws over Russia next. First of all, the Assad regime's rule in Syria represented the linchpin in Iran's overall strategy for confronting their archenemy, the Israelis. Iran's revolutionary government has always been opposed to the existence of Israel and has been locked in a shadow war across the Middle East with Tel Aviv for decades. The Assads in Syria, though lacking Iran's particular ideology of Islamist revolutionary fervor, shared the exact same enemies as revolutionary Iran had: Israel, the United States, and Saddam Hussein's Iraq. This led to Syria under Assad family rule quickly aligning itself to the Young Islamic Republic as a mutual bulwark against their shared enemies. Syria became the first Arab state to recognize Iran's new revolutionary government after 1979, and it was the only Middle Eastern state to openly support Iran during its brutal 8-year war against Saddam's Iraq throughout the 1980s. In the aftermath of that war, Syria and Iran remained mutually aligned against their shared enemy, Israel. And so, the Assads in Syria granted the Iranians open access to their country's territory in order to fly in arms, supplies, and advisors who were then able to travel into neighboring Lebanon, where they trained up and built an organization out of Lebanon's Shia Muslim community that eventually became known as Hezbollah. Syria's deep friendship with Iran and its space on the board made it an invaluable asset to Iran's strategy in confronting Israel, effectively serving as Iran's most important land bridge towards Iran's most important proxy force, Hezbollah in Lebanon. After the collapse of Saddam's anti-Iran and anti-Syria government in Iraq after 2003, Iran's logistical supply route to Hezbollah was even further opened up by land and air alike, enabling Iranian trucks escorted by friendly Shia paramilitaries in Iraq to travel continually through Iraqi territory and then friendly Syrian territory directly to Hezbollah in Lebanon. This was how, over a span of years across the late 2000s and the 2010s, Iran was able to arm and build up Hezbollah directly on Israel's northern border into a truly formidable fighting force. With an estimated 50,000 fighters and around 150,000 missiles and rockets by 2023, which earned Hezbollah the recognition of being the most heavily armed non-state actor in the entire world, and Iran's most valuable foreign asset. Hezbollah's massive fighting force and its arsenal of missiles and rockets effectively became Iran's ultimate insurance policy, against the risk of a direct Israeli or American air campaign against their own nuclear and military sites or government infrastructure in Iran. If the Americans and the Israelis ever decided to bomb Iran, Iran could always just authorize Hezbollah to rain down their hellfire upon Israel from Lebanon, thus ensuring some form of mutually assured destruction and deterrence against Israel or the United States from ever doing so. It was Iran's strategy to put pressure on Israel and to keep any fighting between them far away from Iran's own borders. And thus, Syria's territory was the absolute linchpin in this entire strategy. Because without it, Iran would have no way to continue resupplying and supporting Hezbollah in Lebanon. This is why, when the civil war erupted in Syria and the Assad government looked like it might collapse, Iran and Hezbollah both intervened directly on Assad's behalf against the rebels, with thousands of foot soldiers and fighters in order to keep their supply route open against Israel. So now, after the Assad regime's sudden collapse at the end of 2024, Iran has also probably lost that invaluable land bridge across Syrian territory that they've been able to reliably use to support Hezbollah and Lebanon with for decades, ever since Hezbollah's very founding. To make matters even worse, Hezbollah was also very badly bloodied by the Israelis during their war between September and November of 2024, right before the Assad regime collapsed. Israel had managed to catastrophically infiltrate Hezbollah as an organization, and through a series of major surprise attacks, they were able to destroy the organization's communications and eliminated virtually all of Hezbollah's top leadership, including Hezbollah's top leader himself, Hassan Nasrallah. Thousands of Hezbollah's rank-and-file fighters were either killed or incapacitated by the Israeli attacks. And by November of 2024, with Hezbollah effectively paralyzed and incapable of responding effectively, the IDF claimed that the relentless aerial campaign against Hezbollah had successfully destroyed more than 80% of the organization's once-feared missile and rocket arsenal. Indeed, Hezbollah's catastrophic losses inflicted by the Israelis led directly to the Syrian rebels calculating that they would be too weak to intervene in Syria to save Assad once again, which contributed to their ultimate victory in overthrowing Assad so rapidly without Hezbollah's support. So now, with Hezbollah compromised and spent force with as much as 80% of their Iranian-supplied missile and rocket arsenal destroyed, and with the Assad regime in Syria toppled, Iran will find it incredibly difficult, if not even impossible, to rebuild Hezbollah back into even a fraction of the menace it used to appear to the Israelis prior to 2024. And with that, Iran's ultimate insurance policy against an Israeli and American attack has been completely undone. The loss of Assad in Syria also means that Iran has lost the only UN member state that was truly aligned to it in the Middle East. And with Hezbollah now crippled and firmly isolated from Iran, and with Hamas being increasingly destroyed in Gaza, Iran's entire strategy of putting pressure on Israel's borders and keeping the fight away from their own borders, that they spent decades carefully putting into place, was completely undone in only a matter of days. And then, to make matters still even worse for Iran and Hezbollah, the Israelis have taken steps since the fall of the Assad regime to increase their momentum and advantages even further. On the 8th of December, the very same day that the Assad regime was actively collapsing and Assad himself fled Syria to Russia, the IDF's ground forces seized on the opportunity and advanced from their positions in the Golan Heights to occupy the Purple Line, the UN-established buffer zone between the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights taken from Syria in 1967, and the rest of Syria that was established after the Yom Kippur War in 1974. Since the Syrian army withdrew from their side of the Purple Line as the Assad government was actively collapsing, the Israelis were able to seize control over it and some surrounding areas without even having to fire a shot. In total, the Israelis seized control over an area in Syria about two-thirds of the size of the Gaza Strip. And though it'll be universally rejected by the new Syrian government and by international law, and despite Israel insisting that the new occupation is only temporary, Israel will be very unlikely to ever give it up voluntarily, because of how immensely strategically important it is for them. The most important part of the Purple Line that the Israelis took over in the advance was the Syrian side of the summit of Mount Hermon. At an elevation of 2,814 meters above sea level, it's the highest point anywhere in Syria and the highest geographical point in the region for 100 kilometers. By taking control of the mountain summit, Israel has opened up the ability to position their artillery there to be within striking range of the Syrian capital, Damascus, only about 40 kilometers away. Even more importantly, in the past, the towering height of Mount Hermon outside of Israel's control also created a significant blind spot in Israel's northern early warning radar defenses. Based on the summit of Mount Meron, at just 1,204 meters above sea level, the highest elevated point anywhere within Israel's internationally recognized borders, these radar systems struggle to see anything beyond the towering height of Mount Hermon about 60 kilometers away, which stands over 1,600 meters higher up in elevation than Mount Meron does. As a result, low-flying drones and other aircraft from Hezbollah or Iran could take advantage of this blind spot to infiltrate into Israel's northern airspace undetected. While the cover provided by Mount Hermon enabled Hezbollah and Iran to establish their primary smuggling routes from Syria to the north of the mountain, and which also connected Hezbollah's two zones of control in southern Lebanon and the northeastern Bekaa Valley with each other. But now with Israel's takeover of Mount Hermon's summit, all of these capabilities that Hezbollah and Iran have enjoyed ever since Hezbollah's founding have been effectively eliminated. In time, Israel will establish early warning radar, observation, and air defense systems on the mountain's summit that'll enable the Israelis to see deep into both Syria and Hezbollah's strongholds in Lebanon like they've never been able to do before. Sensors placed at the top of the mountain will be able to intercept local communications. All of Hezbollah's traditional smuggling routes from Syria will be openly within the IDF's lines of sight, while low-flying drones and missiles fired into northern Israel will no longer be capable of exploiting the mountain as a blind spot. All of this means that even if Syria somehow remained friendly to Iran and Hezbollah, which is extremely unlikely, Hezbollah's ability to receive resupplies and arms from Iran has still been severely compromised just by Israel's seizure of Mount Hermon. Moreover, Israel also took further steps after the seizure of Mount Hermon to expose Iran itself to a major direct attack the likes of which it has never been before in its entire history. Over the following 8 days after the Assad regime collapsed in Syria as the country was incapable of responding, the Israeli Air Force carried out an enormous bombing campaign all across the country that saw Israeli warplanes striking targets in Syria around 600 times. It's since been described as the largest aerial operation ever carried out in the history of the Israeli Air Force, and it relentlessly targeted the Assad regime's arms depots, weapon storage sites, air bases, naval assets, anti-air batteries, radar installations, and weapons production sites. Through all of these attacks, the Israeli Air Force claims to have completely destroyed the entire Syrian Navy, and to have blown up roughly 80% of Syria's strategic heavy weapons. More importantly, the Israelis also claim to have crippled all of the radar systems in Syria, and to have destroyed around 90% of Syria's surface-to-air missiles, and their accompanying launch systems. The Israelis claim that this entire operation was done in order to prevent the Syrian army's assets from coming into the hands of an unpredictable new government in Syria that might or might not turn out to be hostile to Israel. But the real reason that the Israelis appear to have done all of that is to open up the door to a major direct attack on Iran itself. Some officials in the Israeli military have characterized this operation as having turned the whole of Syria into a so-called sterile defense zone. With practically all of the Syrian army's radar, early warning, and anti-air systems destroyed by the operation, the Israelis have essentially opened up the whole of Syrian airspace to their own unrestricted use for whatever operation they want to pursue there. Before this, the Israeli Air Force was highly constrained in the types of operations that it can actually conduct directly against Iran because of Syria and its close ties with Iran. Israel has already acquired a total of 39 ultra-modern F-35 stealth fighter jets from the United States, and they've placed orders for another 36 more of them, which notably makes them the only country in the Middle East that actually operates the F-35. Now, the F-35's stealth capabilities were advanced enough that they could have flown across Syrian airspace undetected by Syria's older and largely Soviet-era air defenses. But the problem is that they only have an operational range of around 1,200 nautical miles for combat missions. The northernmost airbase in Israel the fighter jets can actually operate out of is Ramat David Air Base here, and it's about 630 nautical miles away from Iran's furthest west border as the crow flies, which means that Israel's incredibly expensive F-35s couldn't fly through Syria's air defenses and attack targets in Iran and also have enough fuel left over to return back home again. In order to give the F-35s the range they actually needed, they would need to be accompanied by aerial refueling tanker aircraft. Now, the Israeli Air Force possesses several of these kinds of aircraft from the United States. But the problem is that unlike the F-35s, the tankers are big, slow, and not stealthy at all, which basically makes them sitting ducks to air defenses and service-to-air missiles, even to the more outdated Cold War-era systems that Syria had. This meant that for basically all of modern history, Syria's dense concentration of air defenses eliminated the Israeli Air Force's ability to ever sustain a long-range direct attack on Iran, while its radar systems also provided the Iranians with an early warning system to alert them to any incoming Israeli aerial attack as well. Now, however, with the Assad regime gone and with all of Syria's radar and air defenses destroyed and sterilized, Israel has essentially kicked down the gate that was defending Iran against a massive Israeli air assault for decades. And with their neutralization of Hezbollah, Israel has also eliminated Iran's biggest insurance policy that they had against a massive Israeli aerial assault as well. Iran now has no credible deterrence to threaten Israel with to discourage them from launching a direct attack. And they have no capability to prevent the Israeli Air Force from flying directly to their own borders through Syria and Iraq. It's been estimated by some of the Syrian rebels that it'll take decades to recover Syria's lost military capabilities that Israel destroyed during their airstrikes. Iran itself has very capable air defenses and detection systems on their own territory, but Israel now has the ability to use Syria as an aerial launching pad towards them. A fleet of Israeli fighters and tankers could use this opportunity to fly across Syrian airspace to the northeast of the country, where the tankers could then linger in safety while the fighters continue on into Iran to bomb sensitive military and nuclear sites and even centers of the Iranian government. Then, the fighters could return back to northeastern Syria, load up on fuel with the lingering tankers, and then they could all return safely back to their bases in Israel again. All of this could even give the Israelis the option of conducting a major aerial raid against the Iranian capital itself, Tehran, where they could seek to kill the country's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, along with other senior members of the regime. As shown by Israel's aerial bombing campaign against Hezbollah in the Lebanese capital Beirut in 2024, Tel Aviv has shown that they are both capable and willing to eliminate senior leadership even in foreign capitals. And now that they've just acquired the capability to do that against Iran too, even without the external support of the United States, they might decide that the window of opportunity they've acquired will just be too good of one to give up. In October of 2024, the Israeli Air Force did carry out a major attack against Iran, but the Biden administration in the United States pressured the Israelis into avoiding any attacks against Iran's valuable nuclear or oil facilities. With the new Trump administration and the White House next, however, these restrictions from America will likely not bind Israel in the near future. Trump has repeatedly expressed his support to giving the Israelis a freer hand in fighting Iran and its proxies in the Middle East. And unlike Biden, Trump is much more likely to approve of a major Israeli airstrike against Iran now that they have the opportunity to do so. And the Israelis are probably now just waiting for the green light to do so. With Trump coming back into office in Washington and his promise to return the policy of maximum pressure on Iran again, with Assad's collapse in Syria, Hezbollah's crippling in Lebanon, and Hamas's looming destruction in Gaza, Iran has never found itself more isolated and exposed to its enemies since Saddam's Iraqi invasion in 1980, more than 40 years ago. And their entire strategy of confronting Israel that they've carefully pursued for decades now has just been completely undermined. Alright, now let's move on to the equally catastrophic consequences for Russia that have resulted from the collapse of Assad in Syria, too. Russia and the Assad dynasty in Syria had a very long and very mutually beneficial relationship. After Bashar al-Assad's father, Hafez al-Assad, first rose to power in Syria in 1971, he almost immediately agreed to lease the port of Tartus on the Syrian coast to the Soviet Navy. Tartus then became an extremely strategically important asset to the Soviets, as it was the only Soviet naval base located anywhere on the Mediterranean Sea. It enabled the Soviet Navy to use Tartus as a resupply and replenishment base to support their operations in the Mediterranean, without them having to pass through the NATO-controlled Turkish Straits back to their own domestic ports on the Black Sea. Without Tartus, the Soviet Navy would not have been able to operate anywhere in the Mediterranean effectively, and thus they wouldn't have been able to credibly threaten NATO's southern flank from the Mediterranean, while the base also served as a sort of Soviet counterweight to America's primary Mediterranean naval base in Naples, Italy. The Soviets also rewarded the Assads in Syria for granting them the Tartus naval base lease by lavishing them with military and diplomatic support. Between 1950 and 1991, a whopping 94% of all of Syria's arms imports came exclusively from the Soviet Union, including hundreds of fighter aircraft and artillery pieces, thousands of tanks and infantry fighting vehicles, and notably, more than 13,000 surface-to-air missiles and 7,500 anti-tank missiles. Thousands of Soviet advisors were deployed to Syria to assist with the country's country's war against Israel during the Yom Kippur War in 1973, while Syria was the sole Arab state not to condemn the Soviet Union over its invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. The relations ran deep, and they continued to remain close after the collapse of the Soviet Union in the 1990s. Russia remained the primary arms supplier of Syria, while Syria continued to lease the port of Tartus to the Russian Black Sea Fleet. In 2005, Syria agreed to allow the Russians to expand their naval facilities in Tartus in exchange for Russia writing off more than 70% of Syria's $13 billion debt that was left over from the Soviet era. As Russia's relationship with the West began to deteriorate after their invasion of Georgia in 2008, Bashar al-Assad reportedly even allowed the Russians to transform Tartus into a permanent naval base and to station nuclear-armed submarines at the base. Thereafter, Tartus likely became a critically important component to Russia's overall conventional and nuclear deterrence strategies, since it certainly enabled Russian warships armed with long-range missiles to operate in the Mediterranean within striking distance of NATO targets in southern Europe, and it likely enabled their nuclear-armed submarines to operate freely within the Mediterranean as well, and all without them having to pass through the still NATO-controlled Turkish Straits back towards their home ports on the Black Sea to replenish and resupply. After the civil war in Syria erupted against Bashar al-Assad's rule in the country in 2011, Russia diplomatically supported his regime by using its position as a permanent member on the UN Security Council to veto multiple resolutions by Western and Arab countries that called for sanctions or military intervention in Syria, while Russia dramatically stepped up the arms deliveries it made to Assad through their continued lease over the port at Tartus. Then, in 2015, as it appeared that the Assad regime was on the brink of imminent collapse in Syria with dramatic rebel advancements, Russia initiated a massive, full-scale military intervention in Syria in order to save Assad and to save their continued access to the port at Tartus. Around 20,000 Russian military personnel were deployed to Syria, while the Russian Navy and Air Force spent years relentlessly bombarding rebels and civilians across the country that killed thousands of people. During the Russian intervention, the Assad regime allowed the Russians to construct a new major air base for their aerial operations in the country here at Hmeymim within Syria's Latakia province, which became the nerve center for Russia's aerial operations throughout Syria and the Middle East. By 2017, the Russian military intervention had largely stabilized Assad's position in Syria, and in return, Assad led Syria into signing an agreement with the Russians that granted them a 49-year-long lease to both the naval base at Tartus and the new air base at Hmeymim, theoretically lasting up until the year 2066. In just about all but name, the agreement also made both bases effectively sovereign pockets of Russian territory within Syria. Russia was granted sole sovereign jurisdiction over both of the bases, while Russian personnel and material at the bases were granted full legal immunity from Syrian jurisdiction. In the aftermath, both of these bases they carved out in Syria became enormously critical assets to Russia's geopolitical objectives. They enabled Russian naval and air power to be projected beyond the Black Sea into the Eastern Mediterranean and into the Middle East. And they most critically enabled Russia to expand their military operations into other theaters far away from Russia's own borders. They enabled Russia to basically be able to leapfrog their military support from the Black Sea to Syria, and then to the forces of Field Marshal Khalifa Haftar and the Libyan National Army during the Libyan Civil War, while they also enabled Russia's expeditionary adventures using the Wagner Group and later the Africa Corps in countries like Sudan, the Central African Republic, Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali. Hmeymim and Tartus in Syria became the critical bases in the center between Russia itself and Russia's military operations in Africa, which served multiple important objectives. By supporting Khalifa Haftar's forces in Libya, Russia hopes to disrupt Libya's normally large oil supply to Europe as much as possible, and to build a military base located in Africa itself to project power even deeper south into the continent. By supporting the junta-led governments in Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, Russia hopes to disrupt Niger's large uranium supply to the nuclear reactors in France, and to disrupt France's influence in their former colonies in Africa as much as possible. A highly successful strategy that has contributed to the French being forced to withdraw their military presences from Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, Chad, and Senegal, all just since 2022 after the invasion of Ukraine. In many of these cases, especially in the Sahel states and in Sudan, Russian mercenaries fight on behalf of government forces and stabilize their regimes, and are then granted valuable contracts on mining operations and resources like gold and diamonds. The business model, if you can even call it that, that Russia and the Wagner Group pioneered and established in Africa is basically that Russia flies in mercenaries to stabilize unpopular or isolated African governments, and then they fly out valuable minerals like gold and diamonds back to Russia that are hard to transport track and which enable Russia to evade the sanctions that have been imposed on them by the West after the invasion of Ukraine. And it's the Russian bases in Syria that they secured after 2017 that made this entire strategy possible, especially the major air base at Hmeymim that enables heavy Russian cargo aircraft the ability to use it as a refueling and logistical center between Russia itself and all of their operations in Libya and the rest of Africa. These were the reasons why Russia so heavily supported Assad's government in Syria and intervened so heavily against the rebels in the country, and why Russia's interests in Syria perfectly aligned with Iran and Hezbollah's interests in Syria as well, and why they all cooperated together there, which formed the foundation for the modern close relationship between Russia and Iran that's been evolving in other theaters too, like in Ukraine. But now, with the collapse of Assad's government in Syria, Russia's enormous investment into propping him up in the country now seems like it might all go up in smoke. And Russia's continued access to TARDIS and Hmeymim is more uncertain than it has ever been before. If the new government in Syria revokes Russia's leases and access to the bases, it'll be catastrophic for Russia's current strategy. Without the TARDIS naval base, the Russian Navy will lose the ability to freely operate anywhere in the Mediterranean Sea, especially since due to the ongoing war raging in Ukraine, Turkey has invoked the terms of the 1936 Montreux Convention, which prevents Russia from being able to move any of its warships through the Turkish Straits between the Black Sea and the Mediterranean, or vice versa. So long as the war in Ukraine continues, Russia's ports on the Black Sea are completely inaccessible to the Russian Navy from the Mediterranean. And if they lose access to the TARDIS naval base, they'll also lose their only port on the Mediterranean, too, which will basically eliminate Russia's ability to operate submarines or warships anywhere in the Mediterranean for long periods of time, without any nearby ports to use for resupply or replenishment, which will cripple Russia's ability to credibly threaten NATO with warships and with nuclear-armed submarines in the Mediterranean. And the loss of the Hmeymim air base means that Russia's ability to continue supporting their expeditionary operations across Africa will be severely crippled, if not outright eliminated altogether, with multiple cascading consequences. In the event that they for sure do lose access to their Syrian bases, the Russians in the short term will likely attempt and shift over as much of their military assets as possible from Syria to Libya. Indeed, even before the Assad regime collapsed in Syria, Russia was busy dramatically expanding its military footprint in Libya for months throughout 2024. Khalifa Haftar, the warlord who currently dominates eastern and southern Libya, has allowed the Russians to open and operate four air bases across his controlled territory in Libya in exchange for Russia's military support to his side in the country's civil war, which the Russians spent 2024 expanding and building up their aircraft and troop presences in. These air bases and Haftar's territory in Libya became critical to supporting Russia's operations throughout the rest of Africa, giving Russia an arc of continuous power projection that their aircraft transporting mercenaries and arms could take from Russia, to Hmeymim in Syria, to the air bases in Libya, and then to locations throughout the African interior and vice versa in the other direction with gold and diamonds and other valuable minerals. If Russia lost their access to Hmeymim in Syria, though, it would interrupt this entire logistics corridor by severing the link in the center. Rather than using Hmeymim as a logistical stopover point between Russia and Libya, Russian aircraft would have to fly non-stop between Russia and Libya, which would greatly increase their costs and complexity by requiring more fuel for each flight. Historically, Russia has also used the Libyan port of Tobruk under Haftar's control to transport material and personnel towards their air bases deeper in the country. But now, faced with the potential loss of the TARDIS naval base in Syria, Russia may attempt to pressure Haftar into allowing the Russians to expand their naval presence in Tobruk into a more permanent naval base that could replace TARDIS. But even if he agreed, it would take years to construct the required onshore infrastructure there to support as large of a fleet as the Russians originally had stationed at TARDIS. And it would also result in significant diplomatic pushback from NATO and the United States, who sort of support Haftar's faction in Libya as well. So it's unclear if that would even be a possible move for Russia to pursue, which means that with the loss of TARDIS and Turkey obstructing the Turkish Straits to Russian warships coming from the Black Sea, Russia will find it immensely more challenging to support and resupply their position in Libya by sea, just like how they'll also find it more costly and challenging to support and resupply it by air with the loss of Hmeymim in Syria. This is all very complicated because it means with the loss of the bases in Syria, Russia will find itself coming to rely more on their bases in Libya and their relationship with Haftar, while they'll also find themselves in a weaker position to support those bases and to continue that relationship. And similar to the situation in Syria where Russia and Turkey found themselves supporting opposite sides during that civil war, Turkey also heavily supports the opposite side in Libya and backs the government of national unity that's based in Tripoli. In Syria, the Turkish-backed rebels there sensed Russia's weakness weakness as they focused everything on their all-consuming war in Ukraine. And they launched their attack against the Russian-backed Assad government, confident that Russia was too distracted and occupied by Ukraine to intervene effectively. Now in Libya, with Russia still heavily concentrated on trying to swallow Ukraine and with the probable loss of Russia's bases in Syria that'll complicate their ability to continue supporting Haftar's government, could it be possible that Turkey, confident after their decisive victory supporting the winning side in Syria, will also encourage the side they support in Libya to begin another renewed offensive against the Russian-backed side there, too? For several years since 2020, the civil war in Libya has remained frozen in place between Haftar in the east and the south and the Tripoli-based government in the west, largely because of an understanding between their respective outside supporters. While the Syrian civil war was also frozen between 2020 and the end of 2024, the Turkish-backed HTS rebel faction in the country was holed up and appeared to be cornered within Syria's Idlib province. 3 million Syrians lived there for years under HTS control, and the Turks dreaded the thought of Russia and the Assad regime launching a renewed offensive into Idlib that had the potential of unleashing hundreds of thousands of refugees spilling across the border into Turkey. Thus, if the Turks encouraged their side in Libya to launch a renewed offensive against Russia's side, then Russia can authorize their side in Syria to launch a renewed offensive against Turkey's side in Idlib, and spark that massive humanitarian disaster on Turkey's doorstep. But now, with the Assad regime in Syria toppled and the government there in the hands of the Turkish-backed HTS, Russia's leverage over Turkey that they used to have in Idlib has been completely lost. And so is the understanding between them in Libya. Meaning that Turkey probably feels emboldened to press their advantage and momentum in Libya next. If they end up doing that and Russia finds it too difficult to save Haftar next and Libya comes fully under a Turkish-backed government too, it would firmly eliminate Russia's military presence everywhere on NATO's southern flank. It'll free up Libya's oil reserves for unrestricted export back to Europe again at the expense of Russia's supplies, and it'll completely and irrevocably cripple Russia's military operations in Africa. That'll sever one of their most important methods of evading Western sanctions with African gold and diamonds. Russia cannot afford to let Haftar fall next after Assad. But without Assad, they'll also find it much more difficult to keep hanging on to him. Turkey has long supported the Tripoli-based government in Libya because they agreed to become the first country in the world to recognize Turkey's maritime claims in the eastern Mediterranean. With the victory of HTS in Syria that Turkey backed, it stands to reason that the new Turkish-friendly government in Syria will also eventually extend the recognition of Turkey's maritime claims in the region as well. And if they succeed in toppling Haftar in Libya next, Turkey will have suddenly secured 3 countries in the eastern Mediterranean that'll recognize their maritime claims in the region against the opposition of Greece, Cyprus, and Egypt. And so the legitimacy of the Turkish maritime claims will be greatly strengthened. That is the incentive that Turkey has to twist the knife into Russia's side in Libya next, and why I wouldn't be surprised if they at least tried. And this would be even further advantageous to Turkey and detrimental to Russia. For years, following major offshore natural gas discoveries in the maritime zones of Israel, Cyprus, and Egypt in the later 2010s, an alliance of countries consisting of those 3 plus Greece, Jordan, Italy, and France have pursued a major infrastructure project known as the Eastern Mediterranean Pipeline, or EastMed. If it's ever completed, EastMed would be capable of transporting about 10 billion cubic meters of gas per year to the European market from Cyprus, Israel, and Egypt, equivalent to about 3% of the EU's entire consumption of gas in 2023. The alliance also firmly rejects Turkey's maritime claims in the eastern Mediterranean that would overlap with the planned route of the pipeline between Cyprus and the Greek island of Crete, while the pipeline would also completely circumvent all Turkish territory. Naturally, then, Turkey is opposed to this alliance and to the EastMed project as it's currently envisioned. The project has already been indefinitely stalled since the United States withdrew its support for it in 2022. But if Turkey could push out Haftar from Libya and secure both Libya and Syria's support for their maritime claims in the region, Turkey would acquire the leverage to try and force the EastMed countries into rerouting the pipeline overland instead through Syria. This was never really a possible option until right this very moment, because nobody would have routed the pipeline through Syria while it was still an active war zone. If Turkey and their supported side in Syria can manage to stabilize the country, though, they can present the option of rerouting the pipeline from Cyprus, Egypt, and Israel through Syria to link up with Turkey's already existing gas infrastructure onwards to Europe, which would further undermine Russia's energy leverage over Europe in the process. And that's nothing compared to another, even larger possibility to further undermine Russia's energy influence in Europe that's been presented by the collapse of the Assad regime as well. The largest natural gas field ever discovered in the entire world by orders of magnitude is the South Pars North Dome field located in the center of the Persian Gulf between Iran and Qatar. This field is so enormous, it alone contains more gas reserves than the next 10 largest gas fields ever discovered all combined. The field became the foundation of the Qatari state's modern colossal gas industry, and how the little country was able to become the third largest natural gas exporter in the world, behind only Russia and the United States. However, Qatar has always been restricted by how much gas they can actually export out of the field because the country doesn't have any pipelines that can carry the gas out to markets over land. All of Qatar's natural gas exports are done through liquefied natural gas or LNG exports instead, where the gas is supercooled into its liquid form and loaded onto ships with refrigerated containers for transportation around the world. To put the scale of the advantage of pipelines into context, Norway is currently able to export nearly as much gas as Qatar does abroad despite having reserves that are only about 7% the size of Qatar's reserves. Because, unlike Qatar, Norway has a web of pipelines that they used reliably and constantly transport gas to Europe through. If Qatar had pipelines that connected its world-leading reserves of gas to Europe, it could theoretically supply all of Europe's current gas needs all on its own for an entire century, which would probably be long enough to carry Europe all the way through towards full decarbonization. In the late 2000s, Turkey and Qatar began establishing an alliance between them across the Middle East, owing to their government's mutual support of political Islamism in the region. And in 2009, they first suggested the concept of building out a massive gas pipeline from Qatar through Turkey and onwards to the market in Europe. However, in order for the pipeline to actually reach Turkey from Qatar, there were only two possible geographic options to choose between. The pipeline could either be routed through Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Iraq towards Turkey, or it could be routed through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Syria towards Turkey. The first option through Iraq was immediately discarded over that country's chronic instability at the time, and so the route through Syria was the one that became the most heavily pursued. However, the Assad government in Syria quickly rejected the whole idea and refused to consider routing the pipeline through their territory at all, even though they would have received lucrative transit fees if they had agreed to it. And they almost certainly rejected it because they were pressured into rejecting it by their patron Russia, who feared how badly a massive gas pipeline from Qatar into Europe would reduce their own energy leverage over Europe in the process. And this was another massive, though less discussed reason why the Russians so heavily supported Assad during the later civil war in the country, in order to guarantee that they would keep locking Syria's space off of the board for this pipeline into Europe from Qatar. And so the Qatar-Turkey gas pipeline proposal was indefinitely shelved, and multiple geopolitical issues in the region kept it shelved for the past 15 years. Syria collapsed into a civil war that further kept its territory off limits. Iraq continued to remain chronically unstable, while Saudi Arabia even blockaded Qatar for years between 2017 and 2021, that kept its territory off limits to any potential Qatari pipelines as well. But the Saudi blockade ended in 2021, and now with the collapse of the Assad regime in Syria and the installment into power there of a government backed by both Turkey and Qatar, the prospect of opening Syria's space on the board back up to the Qatari pipeline to Europe has emerged once again. And this is how the collapse of Assad in Syria could end up most catastrophically hurting the Russians. It only took 2 days after Assad had fled the country for the Turkish energy minister, Alparslan Bayraktar, to publicly suggest that the Qatar pipeline project could soon become revived once again were Syria to achieve its territorial integrity and stability, which Turkey will no doubt attempt in support even with military action against any remaining rebel forces in Syria who are opposed to HTS. If Syria is able to be secured and stabilized in the future, then the Qatar gas pipeline project routed through Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Syria to Turkey and onwards to Europe could soon become an actual reality. And if that happens, Europe will never, ever again have to buy a single drop of natural gas from Russia, and the Kremlin will lose all of its remaining energy leverage over Europe. There are some in Russia who hope that in the future, after the war in Ukraine is concluded one way or another, the Europeans will eventually return back to business as usual with Russia and resume purchasing massive amounts of their natural gas again. But if they had this pipeline from Qatar, the Europeans would have the choice of just never doing that, and never finding themselves reliant on Russian energy and susceptible to Russian influence and pressure again. Instead of Russia being the most important link to Europe's gas supply, Turkey is attempting to position itself as that most important link instead. They are steadily becoming the invaluable crossroads between the marketplace in Europe and the gas supplies located all around them. They already, across their territory, carry pipelines into Europe from Azerbaijan, Iran, northern Iraq, and Russia. And in the future, they may add these additional pipelines from Cyprus, Israel, Egypt, and Qatar. And in the process, they will become the arbiter of Europe's gas supply. And they will establish the energy leverage over Europe that Russia used to have. Ultimately, the collapse of the Assad regime in Syria has been absolutely catastrophic for the ambitions of both Iran and of Russia, and the full implications for them will play out slowly over the next several years. But I expect that they'll generally follow the course of events that I explained here. The rebel offensive in Syria itself that overthrew Assad, and that was spearheaded by HTS and other Turkish-backed rebels in the country, proved to be probably the single most shocking geopolitical development of the entire year in 2024. Hardly anybody was expecting that the Assad dynasty in the country that had lasted for 54 years, which had survived through devastating blows during the past 13 years of the Syrian civil war, would collapse so rapidly in only 11 days after the offensive began. But there are several reasons why that happened. Assad himself was more isolated and exposed than he had ever been before, with all of his outside allies that historically supported his regime heavily preoccupied with their own affairs. The 4 years of general calm in Syria that was maintained since 2020 probably led to an expectation in Syria of a return to normalcy that Assad was never able to deliver on, leading to a demoralized and increasingly unsupportive population and armed forces. And in this video's next part, I will explain all of this to you in full detail. How and why Assad's regime collapsed so rapidly, and what exactly took place during those 11 days that the rebels stormed through the whole country and forced Assad himself to flee into exile in Russia. But unfortunately, due to the inherently violent, controversial, and recent nature of discussing this offensive that covers themes like terrorism, extremism, the Assad regime's extensive use of death camps and torture, and rampant crimes against humanity, this next part of the video explaining all of that to you will cause the rest of the video before it to become demonetized and age-restricted, which ultimately would mean that YouTube's algorithm would have never promoted any of this video to you, and you probably never would have seen any of it as a result. But thankfully, I was still able to produce the next part of this video anyway because of the power of this video's sponsor, Nebula, where you can go and watch the next 40-minute part covering exactly how the rebel offensive in Syria transpired and why it ended up being so unexpectedly decisive and victorious in outcome. And this is also just one of more than several dozen exclusive, full-length real-life lore videos that you can only find on Nebula in my overall Modern Conflict series there, which can all only be found over there because of all of their darker, more controversial subject material. That means that there's a bunch of other previous episodes that you can also go and watch right now that were very relevant to this video, too. Like this episode covering the general overview of the whole Syrian civil war from its start in 2011 to its ceasefire in 2020. This episode that focuses exclusively on the Russian military intervention into Syria. This episode that concentrates on the biggest battle of the civil war that was fought over Aleppo. These episodes that cover the rise and fall of ISIS in Syria. Or this episode that focuses on the conflict between Turkey and the Kurds in the region. All of which will help give you an incredible amount of context into what just happened in Syria and why. And what's even more, you also get access to all of the other amazing exclusive content that's available on Nebula too. Because the best part about this site is that it's jointly co-owned by all of its creators, built by myself and hundreds of other independent YouTubers and podcasters. And because it's a subscription-based service, we all get to work on way bigger and higher budget productions over there than we could ever do on our own on YouTube. That's why there's tons of other exclusive content that you'll find equally fascinating from all of these other creators over there who you probably also already know as well. And best of all, if you sign up by clicking the button that's here on your screen right now, or by following the link that's down below in the description, you'll receive an insane 40% discount off of an annual subscription, which means it'll only cost you $3 a month or $36 a year for all of this awesome exclusive content from myself and hundreds of other independent creators, with even more stuff getting added by me and everyone else every single month. And if you already have a Nebula subscription and you want to gift one to a friend or a loved one, one, you can now do that as well with a gifted subscription with the same discount by following the link that's down below in the description as well. This is the absolute best way to help support what I'm doing here on Real Life Lore. And as always, thank you so much for watching.